Well, this evening we're going to continue a study that we began this morning. Started a study about instrumental music this morning, and we'll conclude with it tonight. It is a study that I hope will be of interest and of help to you. And what we did basically this morning, for those of you that may not have been able to be here, essentially what we did was to look at what the Scriptures have to say about authority and the importance of authority in the things that we believe and the things that we practice. The Scriptures say that there are some things that it doesn't matter what we do. The issue of, and they can be about some very critical things, by the way. The issue about the eating of meats. If you recall a passage like Romans 14, that speaks to what was a critical issue, but essentially the Apostle Paul says it doesn't matter if you eat meat or if you don't eat meat. It doesn't commend you to God, and abstaining from it doesn't commend you to God either. And there's some things that it just doesn't matter, and we choose, we make choices about. But there are some things about which God has spoken in His Word, and it, when God does speak about something, it matters, and it ought to matter to us. And we tried to look this morning at some scriptures and in which God addresses the issue about worship and worship of Him. We talked about the fact that Jesus makes it plain in Matthew chapter 28 that He is the one who has all authority in things that pertain to God and matters having to deal with spiritual things. He alone has all authority. He has spoken to us, Jesus, that is, the one with all authority, through His apostles. And we took some time to take note of the fact that we read in the book of Acts and read in the epistles as well of how the apostles set about to put into order certain things. They brought about order to the Lord's church. They did this by providing instruction from Jesus. They provided instruction in what the Lord wanted them to do as a group of people who were assembled together, who were organized together, working together, things the Lord wanted accomplished, and they learned through the apostles what the Lord wanted that. And that was God bringing order to His church. And we looked at some passages then that had bearing upon the way that they worshiped. 1 Corinthians 14 was one, Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3 were a couple of others that we looked at that spoke to the fact that when these early Christians assembled together in order to worship, that part of what they did was they sang. And in that instruction, that ordering that the apostles brought to the Lord's church, we noted the fact that it's significant that they spoke about the singing that those Christians did and that they were to do and how they were to do it and so forth. It's significant that they spoke to that. And it is significant that they did not speak to the issue of the use of instruments in that worshiping that was done. Nowhere in the New Testament is there anything addressed to the use of instruments of music in the worshiping of God, in the honoring of God. It's just not there. That says something to us. And we took note of the fact that that's not because the people of that historical era didn't know anything about instruments. They knew a lot about instruments. They had them. They possessed them. They used them. The Old Testament tells us about how the Jewish people employed instruments of music in their worship services in the temple, and the way that God regulated that. Now, all of that just makes the point that instruments were something that were prevalent. People knew about them. They knew how to use them. In fact, we even looked at some historical information that indicated that among the early Christians, there were very early on, there were efforts to incorporate those instruments in the worship service. And we have writings from some who spoke out in opposition to that. What all of that just does is it establishes for us, first of all, the fundamental principle that, I mean, we're not going to accomplish anything unless we are agreed upon the fact that there has to be an authority in our religious beliefs. There must be somebody who has the right to say, here's what I want done, here's the way I want it done, and so forth. Well, you've got to establish that kind of authority. And so hopefully we did that this morning and related how the apostles fit into all of that. And then also perhaps showed some information that establishes the fact that people of that first century era, when the church was established, had access to instruments. And the fact that we read nothing about them in the New Testament is not an inconsequential fact. Well, what I'd like to do this evening for a few moments is just look at a couple of things that would relate to perhaps some questions that people might have regarding this issue. And I noted this morning that I understand that a lot of folks don't have any interest in this. They don't see it as any big deal. They see this as kind of silly, David. I mean, why are you taking time with this? Reminds me of a true story about a friend of mine. He's a preacher. He was asked by a preacher friend of his to fill in for him speaking at a retirement home where they had services, and this fellow was going to speak. Something came out that conflicted in the schedule, so he asked my friend. My friend agreed to go. Well, just shortly after agreeing to go, my friend got to thinking, you know, I mean, this obviously is probably a gathering where it's going to be a wide range of people, religiously speaking, I mean, you know, of religious backgrounds. They're going to come from different backgrounds. And he got to thinking, you know, that might present a problem. And particularly, he was thinking about the use of instrumental music in a worship service, how widely that is embraced by people. So many people would never even think about it being, you know, an issue of any kind. Well, he went. He thought, well, surely my friend, he knows the way I feel about that. So he went. Well, he got there, and of course it was in kind of a recreational room, and there was a piano there in that room. He thought, well, I mean, I could just be there for other kinds of activities. And people began to file in and take their seats, and pretty soon a lady came in and she went up and she sat down on the piano bench, you know. He got to thinking, well, I may have a problem there. And the people that organized it all, they came and they introduced themselves to him, and they took him over and introduced him to the lady who was sitting at the piano. Her name was Betty, Miss Betty. Well, things, you know, continued on. time came to start, and they got started, and time came for him to deliver his lesson. He gave his lesson. And well, when he had finished his lesson, he looked over and he saw Miss Betty sitting over there by at the piano, you know, all smiles, looking at him, ready for him to start the song. And he said, "Well, folks," he says, let me take a moment here and just explain something to you." And so he explained to them his conscientious views about what the Bible teaches, and he said to them, I don't want to force my conscience on you." He said, I'll go back here and take a seat, but just let me explain to you why I have this conscientious view." And so he explained to them, you know, very briefly, explained to them why he believed this way. After the services were over, he stood in the back, you know, shaking everybody's hand like a good preacher does. And as folks walked out, you know, he was a little hesitant about all of this, because when Miss Betty actually started to play, she had daggers coming out of her eyes, you know. But people came out, and they were gracious, as people most often would be. In fact, he tells the story that one of the people that came out said, "You know, that was very interesting what you had to say about it. I never thought about that. I'm going to have to think about that." So he thought, hey, you know, maybe. The next person in the line was a lady. It wasn't Miss Betty, by the way. The next person in the line was a lady, and she said, "You know, that you said about instruments and the use of instruments of music and worship and all of that?" He said, "Yes." She said, "I never heard about that. That is the stupidest thing I have ever heard in my life." Well, I understand people are going to react that way. And I'm sure that most of you understand that they're going to react that way as well, from experiences that you've had. And I believe sometimes it's just because they don't understand the facts. For instance, some who know a little bit of something and who have done some study about some of this would look at Ephesians, the 5th chapter, and the Apostle Paul's admonition to his brethren there to speak to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. Some would look at that passage and they would raise the question, "Well, does that phrase make melody? Could that not just as easily be interpreted to mean to play, as in to play an instrument? Seems to me like I read somewhere that, you know, that's what that word, it comes from a Greek word, solo, and that's what that word meant. As I say, that's it was probably unusual if you ever really encountered anybody who said something like that. But some people might have enough knowledge about the issue to know that. And they are, by the way, absolutely correct. They're absolutely right. That's what the word solo meant. That is what it meant centuries before the New Testament era. Before the Apostle Paul wrote it, before he used that word, centuries before that. That's what the word meant. It meant to pluck the string like one would pluck the string of an instrument. Now, by the time of the New Testament, by the time the Apostle Paul wrote this statement in Ephesians 5, the word didn't mean that anymore. When people used the word, the Greek word solo, nobody understood it to make reference to the playing of an instrument of music. It was universally used by that time to make reference to having an effect upon one's heart. Now, some people would look at that and they would say, very convenient, David. Yeah. But I want to tell you something. What we have to recognize, whether we like it or not, what we have to recognize is that words change meaning. Did you know that the word girl at one time, way, way back in our in the history of the English language, the word girl referred to a young person of either gender, male or female. Now today, there's nobody who would use that word in that sense. They would make reference to a girl, and all of us would understand. We're talking about a young female. Do you ever have your kids, you know, get to carrying on in the back seat with one another and fussing and carrying on? He made an awful face at me. Well, what were they saying about that? Well, what they were saying was, he made this hideous, ugly-looking face. Everybody knows that's awful. Is something that's terrible. It's grotesque. Not always. Early in the history of that word, it meant to be full of awe. It meant to be in awe of something. If you said someone was awful, you were saying that person was filled with awe. It wasn't a bad thing at all. Entirely different meaning. Now, let me tell you something about words. Words have no meaning until you put them in their context. The same word, even today, can have different meanings that will be affected by the context that that word is placed in. If that's true of words in their current meanings, it is certainly true that words are going to change over the course of time. So this is, I'm not trying to make some kind of, you know, feeble dodge about what this word means in Ephesians chapter 5. You want a good way to determine that, you know, well, David's not pulling the wool over our eyes, or, you know, this is not some convenient Church of Christ answer, or, you know, things. Look at the way it's translated. Ephesians 5 and verse 19. What does it say? The latter part, he says, singing and making melody with your heart to the Lord. It's translated making melody. David didn't translate that. Nobody in the Tustin Church of Christ translated that. This is not a Church of Christ translation Bible. People of divergent backgrounds with a knowledge of the Greek language, people of a divergent religious background, and it came together in a committee in order to produce this volume of the English translation of the New Testament. My point to you is this: nobody translates the word as meaning to pluck or to play. Nobody translates it that way. Because it's just generally observed, it's understood, it's known that at that point in time, the word had come to mean to make melody, as opposed to the meanings that it previously had had. But now, another question that folks may ask from time to time is, well, when were these instruments introduced? Well, it depends a lot on what you mean by introduced. This morning I read to you some things that indicated that among the early Christians, within the 1st, 2nd, 3rd century, we have writings that indicate that Christians were responding to the effort by some to introduce the use of instruments in the worship, using the common instruments that they were familiar with in their society. So when were instruments first introduced? Well, very early on. But for the sake of our study, I'd like for us to maybe define that idea of introduced a little bit more. To mean introduced and accepted. When were these instruments introduced and accepted? Probably the earliest date that is generally recognized by historians is 670 A.D., when an organ was introduced into the services of a Catholic church by the then Pope. That's 670 A.D. In 812 A.D., there's reference made in historical records to another Catholic church in France where an organ was there introduced. But now you could go on down through history, find various points where a particular church, a particular congregation would embrace this and you would just see as you collected all of this information, over the course of time, you'd see a growing acceptance among people, among religious people. But that doesn't mean that it was without opposition. It was opposition. There was opposition. And 1260 A.D., a name that some of you might recognize, Thomas Aquinas, a significant philosopher, teacher among the Catholic Church, he made this statement: "Our church does not use musical instruments as harps and psalteries to praise God withal, that she may not seem to Judaize." See, in his view, it took upon too much of an appearance, a similarity to the Jewish religion, because of the Jewish religion of Jewish use of instruments of music. But clearly, as one looks at the historical documents, and clearly as time passes, you have more and more acceptance among people to the use of instruments. 15th and 16th centuries, the organ has gained a pretty wide acceptance by that point in time among Catholic churches, and other instruments then began to be embraced. In the 16th century, with the rise of the Protestant Reformation, you have a development in people's attitudes about the use of instrumental music that a lot of people are not aware of. And that is that among the Protestant reformers, now not all of the Protestant reformers had anything to say about instruments and the use of instruments. Some of them said little or nothing. But some of them had quite a lot to say. And among the Protestant reformers, you have some very significant leaders of the Reformation speaking out against the use of instruments of music. The reformer Erasmus had this to say: we've brought into our churches certain operatic and theatrical music, such a confused, disorderly chattering of some words as I hardly think was ever in any of the Grecian or Roman theaters. Now he's commenting on the situation as it existed at that time during the Reformation. He's commenting about the things that he and others were trying to correct within their churches. He goes on and he says, the church rings with the noise of trumpets, pipes, and dulcimers, and human voices strive to bear their part with them. Men run to church as to a theater to have their ears tickled. And for this end, organ makers are hired with great salaries and a company of boys who waste all their time learning these whining tones. Pretty clear where he stood on this and the way he felt about it. But it was very common among Protestant reformers to be opposed to the use of instrumental music. Now, I want to be honest with you. I think a lot of it may have grown out of an anti-Catholic view that if the Catholics were going to use it, then they were going to be opposed to it. There may have been a lot of that going on. I wouldn't deny it. But the point is that a lot of people don't know that there was any opposition of any kind. A lot of folks think, haven't you run into this where folks think, it's silly for you to be asking questions about this. That everybody uses these. What could be wrong with these? Well, and then if there are some who have a little knowledge about you and your religious beliefs, they may, I know all about that. You people in the Church of Christ, you're the ones that don't use instruments. It's a Church of Christ thing. Something you folks came up with and make a big deal out of. Nobody else does. No. Just historically, that is wrong. That is incorrect. It has been an issue. It's been something that has been debated among religious people as long as the church has been in existence. It's not something that the Church of Christ just came up with, and it's an issue that they press and just kind of a quirky view that they hold. No, not at all. So, you ever heard of a guy named John Calvin? Opposed to the use of instrumental music. What do you think about that? You know, some people might say, John Calvin, he's a reasonable sort of guy. I've heard of him. Yeah. And you could go right on down the list with a number of consequential names of people of that era. Now, I just say this just to, if you may be thinking this, to hopefully get you to consider otherwise, and that is that this somehow is just a thing that is attached to churches of Christ and congregations of that church in this country, and that's just not so. If you really want to know the truth about the matter is, is best to describe this as just kind of a conclusion that I've drawn, that others have drawn, not just me, but others have drawn. Fact of the matter is, when you put all of the people together, and what people have believed about the use of instrumental music, the use of instrumental music in worship is the minority position. It is the minority position. When you put all the people throughout history who, the majority of the people have believed not right to use them. That doesn't make it right, and it doesn't make it wrong. I do believe it would be a surprise to a lot of people to find that that is what most people had believed throughout history, throughout church history. What makes something right or wrong, as we talked about this morning, you come right down to it, is not what most people have ever believed, not what most people have ever practiced. It's what the Lord has said, what He's revealed, the one who has all authority. Now, Jesus Christ said, I have all authority. And if you believe that He has all authority, then whatever He says on a matter, well, that'll settle it. And if He says it doesn't matter, then it ought not to matter. Are you living your life in such a way that you demonstrate to the Lord that it matters to you what He says? And that regardless of how other people are going to react to it, you're going to do whatever it is He says. Accept it, believe it, put it into practice. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ, then tonight is the opportunity you have to demonstrate to the Lord that conviction that you have, that you're going to do whatever it is He says. Because He's told men and women to believe, to turn from their sins, and to confess their faith in Christ, and to be baptized, then that's what you'll do. And we pray you'll come as we stand together and sing.